And I think a lot of B2B companies make this mistake, whether they're early stage or whether they're later stage, is like not prioritizing channels. They'll try to do like everything under the sun, or they'll look at where we are at ShipBob today and say, well, ShipBob's doing paid search and paid social and affiliate and TV and out of home and podcasts and everything under the sun. But yeah, we evolved to that stage. Like, we didn't start really going beyond really three core marketing channels. And I'd say five demand gen channels, including outbound and partnerships, until we were well over $100 million in annual revenue.
Today, we're talking e-commerce marketing with Casey Armstrong, the CMO of ShipBob. Casey has worked on both the B2B and B2C sides of e-commerce, and so I'm excited to tackle it from both angles. Welcome to Grow and Tell, the show where revenue leaders tell the growth stories behind today's successful companies. I'm your host, Alex Krakow. Grow and Tell, Grow and Tell. For the past 5 years, Casey has been the CMO of ShipBob, an e-commerce fulfillment platform that earned a $1 billion valuation in 2021. Casey and I went deep on ShipBob's startup marketing strategy, including why they started with only a few channels, how they approach partner marketing, how they've built out their marketing team, and how their messaging has evolved with their ICP. We also got into some fun campaigns, like their branded truck partnerships with Tom Brady and Jennifer Aniston. And one quick favor to ask before we get to the show. If you enjoy the conversation, please do us a favor and hit like and subscribe on YouTube or leave us a rating wherever you listen to podcasts. It really helps us out. I hope you enjoy this episode. So we're going to spend today talking about e-commerce. So I'd love to start today's conversation with your time at Watchmaster, because that sort of seemed to be your first serious foray into the world of e-commerce. I know you were doing a bunch of B2B SaaS stuff before, but would love to kind of hear the story of what is Watchmaster? How did you end up building that company?
Yes. So I actually got connected with the team because a good friend and business partner of mine, Patrick Blaskowitz, we did a bunch of growth workshops and tours all over Europe, which is another story. We actually did 11 countries 1 year, and then the next summer we did 5 countries. And it was actually at our event in, it might have been in Berlin, where I met the CEO and founder of Watchmaster. And so from there we started talking, and then he hadn't started the company yet. And fast forward 9 months later or so, he messaged me and he's like, hey, I'm going to be in California, which people just think California is like everything's close to it. But he was in NorCal, and I'm like, he's like, let's connect. I'm starting this company. Would love to chat. So I actually flew up and met up with him, and we started talking about it. And I just thought, you know, the concept was extremely interesting for Watchmaster. And I actually moved with, I had one child at the time. So my wife and my 1 year old at the time, we moved to Berlin, yeah, to help him get started and scale the business.
So cool. Well, so what was the concept? Was it just like a luxury watch community? Or are you selling it online, or was it a new watch brand? What was Watchmaster?
Yeah, so it was more like a marketplace. And so we would buy directly from the vendors, and also a lot of like the gray market stuff from, we buy from all the major watch companies. So Rolex, Tag Heuer, Breitling, Omega, and it's your typical like 80-20. And in this case, it was more like 95.5, where it was like so heavy on Rolex. And even within Rolex, there were a handful of models that sold extremely well. And within those models, a couple of colors that sold extremely well. So it was a fascinating business. And so honestly, and so we buy and then just look for markup arbitrage as we'd sell directly to consumers, or we'd sell to businesses as well. And so another way I position it too is kind of like that arbitrage. And so we'd buy in the South, when like, let's say the poorer countries of Europe, to be honest, where also there's just different VAT structures. So we'd buy like, let's say in Greece, I think the VAT there, or the VAT, is like 23%. And then we'd sell in the North. And so we'd sell in like Germany, we'd sell in the Nordics, we'd sell in across the UK. This was pre-Brexit. And I think in Germany, I could be wrong because I don't remember all these numbers, but I think like the VAT there is like, which is their tax, is like 19%. And so that alone, even if we sold the same good, depending on how we purchase the watch, that gives us, if we sold it for the same dollar amount, which we wouldn't because Germany's more affluent and we could sell it for more money, that's 4% in profit for us right there. Granted, you know, sans shipping and fulfillment and customer acquisition costs and all that. And in Europe, and actually in UK, we'd actually mark it up quite a bit. So yeah, it was pretty interesting.
So interesting. It's crazy how much the watch market has exploded. I don't know how deep you are watching TikTok, but all those like watch guys on TikTok, I think they're all in New York going to each other's shops and doing the markups and all the games. I mean, it sounds like you were doing that, but like at scale in a digital marketplace. Is that kind of right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, honestly, if we just would have sat on all the watches, and then once the COVID craze came, like watch prices just skyrocket. I mean, you look at just, you know, the bestseller, which is the Submariner, the price of those alone, I think we were buying those for around like 5,000 euros. And I don't know what they are today, but they're a lot more than that right now.
And so you were responsible for growth at Watchmaster. And so I think the numbers were like you grew to 30 million in revenue in the first year. I think my notes are right. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but like, how did you grow it? Was it just that the prices were so attractive that you were able to kind of sell things efficiently, or were you using a lot of digital advertising to draw people in? How did you sort of think about kind of growing Watchmaster?
Yeah, it was a lot digital. And so there were a lot of people involved, or not a lot of people. We had a very small team, but like there were multiple people, of course, involved. So I'm not by any means taking any, like all of the credit. And so like this guy, Philip on the team was, you know, huge in just like from all the digital side. So yeah, a lot of it was digital. But one of the things that helped us a lot, again, other than aggressive digital strategy. And so one of the projects that I helped spearhead that helped a lot too, is we essentially built this like pricing engine. We would look at, okay, what did we purchase the watches for? And what is our minimum? And then how did we purchase it? Because there's several ways you can buy it, which impacts how you can like do like the tax and the sale afterwards. What is our target margin? And then we basically would crawl all of our competitors every single day. And then that would feed into like our pricing algorithm. And so we would try to undercut them to like the nearest $5 increment in euros every single day. And then we'd upload that multiple times a day into like, so our number one channel was actually at the time Google Shopping. And so we would upload that because, you know, we actually had people knew they were searching for, you know, a Rolex Submariner or a Rolex insert the blank, or actually one of the best sellers that we had was, I forget which James Bond movie came out at the time, but Omega had a James Bond watch that just, we could not sell. Like we just kept increasing. We didn't even use our pricing engine for that. We just kept increasing the price. And so that was a huge factor. And so we would just use that and run our algorithm there to feed into our pricing engine and update Google Shopping every single day. And so that helped a lot. So then we were just always, you know, getting, let's just say like the Google version of the buy box. And we were always just that much cheaper just to pull those people over.
It's fascinating. I feel like So many people are thinking about, I mean, the creative, what words do I put in my ads, all of that stuff. But I think like this is such a good story of, okay, it's actually the price that ultimately matters. And like all of that back end work you're doing when it comes to your pricing algorithm, just undercutting by just a little bit. I mean, I'm sure just moved the needle a ton. Yeah. So interesting.
Yeah. It was very numbers driven. And I mean, to take some parallels to like B2B, you know, we wanted to get an at bat. And so sometimes it blew my mind. People sometimes just buy. Our AOV was like 5,500 euros. This is not a cheap purchase. Oftentimes though, they'd want to talk to us on the phone, make sure that we're a real company, get some social proof, understand like what they're buying, see if we have other things for sale. But again, so that's where we wanted to at least use the price to at least give ourselves an at bat and give the sales team a chance to close it. Because without that, you know, then obviously you have no shot to close.
And so after Watchmaster, you kind of went into the like technology and software side of e-commerce, and that's where you still are today. So you're the CMO of ShipBob, where you've led the marketing team for a number of years. But I'd love to kind of go back to those early days. Like, what made you join ShipBob in the first place? And like, can you explain just like what was ShipBob like at the time?
Yeah. So before Watchmaster, even a lot of my background was more in B2B SaaS, and I'd done some B2C. I always liked the B2B side a lot more. And so, you know, when I left Watchmaster, I knew I wanted to get back into just B2B software and specifically in e-commerce. And so I actually joined BigCommerce. So I was at BigCommerce for a few years, which was a lot of fun. And I learned an insane amount. We had a very talented leadership team that I was able to learn from as well, along with some of my colleagues. And then when I was there, ShipBob reached out. And I still remember getting the email. I was not looking for a new role. I hadn't interviewed anywhere else during my whole time at BigCommerce. I got the email and I just delete the email. I go about my day. And then that night I'm like, what was that company with that funny name that's like allegedly growing like this fast? And I've never heard of them. Because at Watchmaster, we did a lot of things really well. You know, we obviously scaled very, very quickly, but I think inventory management and supply chain management and fulfillment, we did not do well. And that was so important for us because, again, we're shipping these extremely valuable goods. And so I felt that pain firsthand. And I was like, okay, if I can partner, you know, with these people that want to create essentially the easy button for fulfillment, which is a very painful and labor intensive and expensive process, then that would be pretty amazing. And so, you know, just from my work in like the B2B SaaS space on the marketing side, again, at the time, BigCommerce or ShipBob was newer and, you know, their presence wasn't extremely well known. I just thought it'd be a strong fit. And so, yeah, just met the founders and saw the product and instantly was like, okay, I need to find a way to join this company.
And so just so I understand it, ShipBob sort of solved the problem of, I guess, all of the shipping. So what happens after you actually buy a product online? There's the fulfillment centers. Where does all this go? And so ShipBob sort of handles all of, like, I guess, the backend infrastructure of actually how do you get it from somebody placing an order on the website to a customer's door?
Yeah. So for some background, because a lot of people won't necessarily know what ShipBob is. So we are a global fulfillment platform. And so, you know, we want to just really make things easy for these small, medium, mid-sized businesses to be able to, you know, sell online and fulfill orders online. And so we have our technology, which is how they power their entire, they can power their entire supply chain through our technology. And that sits on top of our physical infrastructure. And so we have 40 plus facilities, fulfillment centers in the United States. And then we've got another dozen or so in Canada, in the UK, in across the European Union and Australia. So you can send your inventory to us. We hold it. And then whether you're selling it on your, you know, .com store like Shopify, BigCommerce, or Woo, you're selling it through marketplaces like Amazon or Target, you're selling through, you know, physical retail. And so you need us to send it to Nordstrom or Saks or something like that. We can, or, and then, you know, we actually power fulfillment for TikTok. So you want to sell through TikTok. And so no matter how you want to sell and no matter where you want to sell from a global perspective, you know, we can actually do the fulfillment for you. And then you can use our software to manage your entire supply chain.
And I'm curious, like, what ShipBob was like when you joined, because I imagine it took a long time to kind of build out all those different distribution centers and fulfillment centers. Like, how big was the company? What was the state of the marketing team revenue? Can you kind of paint a little bit of a picture for us?
Yeah. So we've fortunately, I think, kept the overall company, again, relative to our size, rather lean, including the marketing team. So I oversee the marketing team. I also see the partnership team as well. But yeah, when I joined, we had four or five fulfillment centers in the US that I was at. We were pretty much solely focused on direct to consumer. So we didn't do all things Omni. I mean, we did some stuff through Amazon, but that was really it. The marketing team, I think, was like three people at the time, plus me. So yeah, we were definitely earlier stage. The company was really founded off of outbound sales. And so I joined, marketing was really, like, call it a year into its evolution. And I joined in 2018. So I've been there for 5.5 years.
And, like, what were your initial goals for the marketing program? You said that, you know, the company was traditionally on outbound sales. Like, when you come in and you have this, like, small team, what do you do to start building a marketing program at ShipBob?
Yeah. So it was a combination of a few things. And so, especially my day one focus was not just marketing, but also the partnership function as well, which leads into some of the marketing, which I'll talk about in a second. And so, good friend of mine who also was on my team at BigCommerce, he left and launched his own SEO agency, which was one of the huge needle movers we had at BigCommerce. And so I knew, and one thing I want to do is, like, and I think a lot of B2B companies make this mistake, whether they're early stage or whether they're later stage, is, like, not focused, like, not prioritizing channels. They'll try to do, like, everything under the sun. Or they'll look at, let's say, where we are at ShipBob today and say, well, ShipBob's doing paid search and paid social and affiliate and TV and out of home and podcasts and everything under the sun. But yeah, we evolved to that stage. Like, we didn't start really going beyond really three core marketing channels. And I'd say five demand gen channels, including outbound and partnerships, until we were well over 100 million in annual revenue. And so people, I think, just spray and pray way too much. And so for us, it was like, okay, what are the channels? And so I won't, unless you want me to, like, get tuned to it. But we essentially, like, you know, create this 2x2 grid, which was essentially, like, impact and confidence. And it's essentially creating this, like, ceiling and floor measure of the different channels. And sort of, okay, well, what channels are going to move the needle? Like, in B2B SaaS, SEO is a proven channel, and we are, like, a known entity. And so, like, we solve a known problem. And so, like, e-commerce fulfillment, e-commerce repeal, those types of things, like, there are search queries for what we do. Whereas some solutions, you know, they just, it's tough to even describe what the solution is. And so people can't even search for it. So anyways, like, okay, well, there's a known problem. So, and SEO works for B2B SaaS, so we're going to focus on SEO. Paid search, same thing. Again, maybe it's like lower in your 2x2 grid because it's so darn expensive. But there's a lot of benefits you can get from that, including data and then like affiliate marketing. And so we're like, okay, we're only going to focus on these. And then SEO, I think a lot of people think, well, it's going to take so long. I think if you do it right and you know how to scale it, you can actually scale SEO really quickly. And so SEO was a huge home run for us early. And at the same time with partnerships too, because I think with partnerships and partner marketing, e-commerce is such like a tight-knit ecosystem. We're really able to get, I think with a lot of the larger partners, or they were larger than us at the time. And so, I mean, to be honest, like what I jokingly told my team there was treat this like you're in high school. So at the time I'm like, Shopify is like the star quarterback. We want to be going to like, you know, we're at the party or whatever with like the star quarterback. It's a popularity contest. And so like, who are these other companies? There's BigCommerce was really big at the time. Klaviyo is huge. Like how do we, Gorgeous was a very up and coming company. Like how do we partner and do things with these other brands, leverage their brand awareness, leverage the confidence that the consumers and sellers have with these brands, or these technology partners of ours, to just really elevate our presence. And so a huge focus there, let's say on the branding side, was more on like the partnership side. And then on the marketing side is really, you know, how do we leverage SEO and how do we leverage paid and the data between the two to really drive, you know, a lot of just data decision making across those channels.
I love this answer, honestly, selfishly, because I think this is how I've been thinking about investing in Doc. I mean, Eric, who's quietly listening as a producer of this call, his background's all in SEO, and that's where we've quietly been investing for a long time. And we're slowly getting into the partner game. One selfish question I want to ask is like, how do you think about scaling SEO quickly? Because we have definitely, you know, we see it working, but it does take some time, I think. And so are there any tricks of the trade you can scale it fast?
I think just to simplify SEO, there's what happens on the site and there's what happens off the site. And so off the site, it's really just link building, which is like old school SEO 101. And it's kind of painful, but you know, that's part of the task at hand. And then on site. And so we spend a lot of time, which we can chat about after the call for sure, is like the pre-writing. And so we probably spend just as much time doing the research in advance of what we're going to write than what we actually write. Because there are ways you can look at signals that different solutions have out there. And so we essentially just have like a playbook of analyze, like what should we even write about? So let's just say the query is e-commerce fulfillment. Well, what are the complementary topics that we also need to discuss to put ourselves in the position to actually rank? So like what is actually valuable? Because we definitely need to write that so people actually click on it and stay on it and share it. But also, there are solutions out there. Well, Google will essentially tell you the signals of the topics that you should also include in it.
Yeah. I don't know if you've ever used that tool ClearScope, but yeah, I think that,
ClearScope for sure.
Right. That is one of those tools that really helps, I think, help you understand like, all right, those keyword clusters. So far, I'm writing about credit cards, I should include the word Visa and MasterCard in there probably too, because those are clusters. All right, cool.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So Patrick, who I mentioned earlier, who I did the tours with, there's so many like businesses that never got off the ground or we didn't put far enough. We actually had a company, we were trying something called Semantic Intent. And that is exactly what ClearScope did. And so we just never productized it. It was so stupid of us, but whatever. Those closed doors opened up others. But I'm glad to see, you know, ClearScope and a couple of others, they've done a great job with these solutions.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting how all these marketing industries sort of evolve over time and mature and people start figuring out. It's, I don't know, that's what makes marketing kind of a fun game, is just a constantly evolving landscape.
Yeah. I think partner marketing helps too, is by, you know, because link building, for example, is very few people enjoy it and it's kind of a pain and it's not like it used to be, call it 10 years ago. And so that's where I think partner marketing can help too, because oftentimes you just need to build, you know, the domain authority by leveraging some of your partners. And so when you start doing these things, you know, let's say with the Shopify's and Klaviyo's and BigCommerce's of the world that are just extremely strong domains, and they're going to be referencing you anyways for the webinar that you're doing or the content that you guys collaborated on together. And so those can just more organically just increase your ability to rank as well.
So when you're building these partner programs, you talked about like, how do you think about going to these partners, catching their attention? And like, what does it actually look like? Are you writing articles, as you just said? Are you doing webinars? Are you giving them money to sponsor a conference? Is it all of the above? How do you sort of think about like the co-marketing programs you're building with these different partners?
It's all of the above, but our focus at the beginning was a lot on webinars and digital events, because those were very scalable. And the guy we had at the time that was overseeing that at ChipBob, who I'd worked with before, he was just very proficient at that. And again, it's very scalable. At the time, it was in high demand. I'd say it waned a bit post-COVID, but I think it's picked up again lately. And you just need to be very creative on, like, at the end of the day, especially if we can run these programs, our partners will gladly participate with us. And if we can fill them with our ideal customer and their ICP as well, they're going to always show up. And so our goal even today is, like, when we host a webinar, we want it to be both quantity and quality better than anything else that they'd get anywhere else. And if they're going to host it, we want to be number one on their list, partners that drove attendees to theirs, because that way we know anytime we do something, the partners are going to want to join ours. And anytime our partners do something, they're going to come asking for us to join. And then obviously you need to make sure that there's overlap in, you know, what the value that the products drive. And so, for example, if we're doing all of the fulfillment and supply chain within the e-commerce space, and then we have, let's say, a platform, there's just this natural crossover of the value that we drive. Or if they're a customer support tool, which is essentially focused on the post-purchase experience like we are, there's just a natural overlap with our products being very complementary of each other. And if we're going after the same customer, and again, you know, the value I talked about earlier just naturally aligns rather well.
I'm curious what you recommend. How should startups sort of think about this? Because I think one of the problems with partner marketing is, as a startup, you don't have a big email list. You're still figuring things out. And so, but you want to go get that big brand's, you know, audience and kind of get their attention. So how do you go about approaching a bigger brand and sort of convincing them to partner up with you? Is it just like, hey, we're going to do all the work, slot in here, and we'll help drive a little bit of leads? Or how do you sort of think about working with those bigger partners?
You have to think about, based off of your team, where can you provide the most outsized value? And so you always need to start with that. It's like this very unselfish view of like, well, how can we be the ones? How can they at the end of the day just be like, okay, well, they overperformed. And so maybe you have an amazing founder that knows the space extremely well and can come on, and maybe people know him or her, maybe they don't, but they can come in and just add a ton of value by joining and sharing their insights, or sharing the data from the company, or sharing customer stories, whatever it may be. And so they're just an awesome person to speak. And another thing could be, well, maybe the marketing manager, whoever it is good at hosting these, because they're not easy. I mean, there's a proven playbook for this, but like, it requires time. It requires the know-how of like how to tie everything together from your marketing automation platform to your podcast platform or your webinar platform, and getting all the partners involved. It's your herding cats. And so maybe it's that. Maybe you are the destination where people can have these and you can grow them over time. And again, you just got to start somewhere. So like during COVID, we launched this thing called Operator Series, where we'd just interview customers, and it started off, I'd say, rather small, you know, 10, 20 people would come. And at the end, you know, we had several hundred people that would be joining for these things. And so don't expect your first one or your first few. I'm sure you felt this way with a podcast. Like, it's not like you're going to be, you know, number one trending webinar on day one, but you've got to start somewhere.
Yeah. We did this webinar play all the time at Lattice. You know, like in the early days, it was hilarious. We had 10 people sitting on there, and I'm sitting in our founder's apartment trying to get it going and build anything, you know, any audience around it. And then you slowly, you know, Bamboo HR was like a big partner, and we would just like beg them to do anything, give them money. We'll do all of the work. We'll drive all of the leads. Just send one email to your list, please. You know, but then over time it just compounded. And eventually, I mean, we ran a virtual event with like 20,000 people. So it like got there over time, but it took 5-6 years to kind of build up that email list.
Yeah. And I bet that helped you guys so much also from a brand perspective, because Lattice is, especially in like the B2B SaaS space, Lattice is so well known. And I'm sure it's from, you know, doing things like that.
Totally. And I think my best partner marketing trick is, I mean, I always find it funny that like for SaaS companies who have conferences they like ask money for partners. And it's like, no, you don't need the 20K sponsorship package. Just get them to drive leads. And so we would do like lead driving packages. And that's how we got like 20,000 people there. It was like, hey, Bamboo, don't give us 20K. Just drive 5,000 people to this event and then you can be here for free. And so that play, I think, worked really well. Underrated play, I think.
Yeah. And that's a lot of people.
Yeah.
Congrats.
It was during COVID. So I think everyone was just bored and needed something to do. I'm curious how you thought about ShipBob's positioning, because it seems like you were going after a known market fulfillment centers, but did you have to evolve the positioning? Did you think you were sort of reinventing an existing category? How did you think about that? And then one side question is like, I have heard you use Amazon on your website a lot. So you seem to sort of anchor ShipBob's positioning, like Amazon level fulfillment and logistics. Like, how do you think about kind of this complex thing of how do you describe ShipBob to the market?
Yeah. So we don't use the Amazon like experience verbiage really anymore. But when we were getting started, we had to, because people didn't know who we were. And I remember even explaining to my friends, I'm here in Southern California, so tech's increased, but you know, it's not like it is in San Francisco and New York and elsewhere. So I remember actually explaining to my friends when I joined BigCommerce, they're like, so what do you do? And I explained it and they just couldn't understand what the heck I was talking about. Maybe that's on me. But when I explained ShipBob and I'm like, oh, you know, it took me like no time at all. I'm like, yeah, we do fulfillment. We're providing this Amazon like experience for these direct to consumer brands. And like in 2 seconds, they're like, oh, that's cool. I totally get it. And so we use that a lot just to like few words as possible. You want, and as succinctly as possible, you want to give this clear message of like, what do we actually do? So you can skip through, you know how it is when we've all evaluated software, and I'm sure you guys dealt with this some at Lattice because Lattice offers so much, is you're like, you know, people are like, so what do you do? Like, what's the value you provide me? But if I'm like, yeah, you get this Amazon-like experience on your website, instantly they're hooked because that's what everybody wants. And so we use that a lot, again, especially before people knew who we were and what we offered. And before, honestly, fulfillment, and I can get this in a second, before fulfillment was, I'd say, really more in the spotlight. And we were really going after SMB brands. And so for us, I think what makes ShipBob interesting is not that software is easy, because it's not by any means, but what's interesting with ShipBob is like, I really view building these companies as like, there's really, you know, your product and engineering access. And then there's an access that's like go to market, and like you need to have those aligned, and that's what's going to drive the business with us. There's like a Z axis, if you will. It's like operations. And so like everything we do on product and engineering needs to mirror or work well with what we do in these physical operations and vice versa. And that takes time to evolve a lot, because now there's like just more stakeholders and there's, again, moving physical goods. But so as our products evolve, we've been able to evolve our messaging, because now, you know, when I started, again, we didn't have global, we didn't have omni, people didn't really know who the heck we were. We couldn't really service mid-market and large mid-market brands like we can today. And so again, that's evolved quite a bit.
I was just saying, you touched on it there, but I'm curious, what was that like ICP journey like for you? Because it sounded like you started SMB, moved up market slowly over time. Did I get that right? Like, how did you sort of think about kind of evolving the customer you were serving?
So this is where I think marketing and sales need to work extremely closely together. And is because you can drive all these leads, but if they're not turning into SQLs or opportunities, whatever nomenclature people use, then, you know, basically where sales says, yes, this is a lead that we have a chance to close, then what's the point of those leads? And those leads are not valuable, or at least not valuable today. And then if those SQLs or opportunities don't turn into closed ones, then like, what's the point there? Because then they're not turning into revenue. And so I think that's where working extremely closely with like the sales or the revenue teams is important, because then you can understand, because maybe they're not bad leads, but they're just bad leads today. Or maybe they're not bad opportunities, but they're bad opportunities today. And so it's just constantly evaluating that. And so we actually did that early on when I joined, where we were able to set a bunch of like, let's say, huge opportunities, but we weren't able to close any of them. And so it's like, okay, well, why? And we're really digging into there. And it's like, okay, well, they need all these companies need A, and all these companies need B, and all these companies need C. Like, we don't have those yet. And so it's, I think, getting a lot of feedback from the deals that you lose, especially those larger deals, to help inform the product roadmap. And so that really was, again, fed into things like global and omnichannel and customization. And then all of a sudden, once you start rolling those things out, then you can start leveraging that in your marketing, regardless of channel. You can start leveraging those in your sales and sales enablement.
I'd love to talk a little bit more about like the Z-axis, as you mentioned, because ShipBob is a fascinating business. You have software, but there's like all these serious costs. You own warehouses and trucks. And so I assume you just don't have like the classic SaaS margins. Like, how does that impact the kind of decisions you make as a business, and especially like those go-to-market decisions? Does that mean you just have like need to drive a more efficient CAC? Are there other interesting implications? Like, how do you think about kind of that dynamic? Because it's pretty unique to ShipBob compared to other SaaS companies.
Yeah, so we're asset light on that. So like we're partnering within these facilities, and same with our trucking partners and the carriers. And so that allows us to have, I'd say, a lot better margins than people would probably expect. But regardless, we have to keep an extremely close eye on payback, as do all companies. And so maybe the overarching theme is working closely with the business leaders across other teams. And so, you know, it's working closely with, let's say, whether it's your sales ops team or it's finance, but understanding what channels are driving which deals and making sure like what are acceptable ROI or LTV to CAC or paybacks for your business. And then I think importantly is looking at it. It's never perfect, and I don't want to get in like a whole spiel about like multi-touch attribution. It's like every marketer's like, it's like the bane of their existence. But even like with a simplified attribution model, like how are you able to attribute like what is actually driving specific revenue? Because like a channel might drive a ton of leads and ton of opportunities, and maybe they're all tiny and the payback does not really pencil. Or maybe it's you're fine having that be a loss leader, but like what is actually really driving the revenue and how can you invest more into those channels?
One channel I'd like to talk about is TikTok, because I think TikTok has had a major impact on e-commerce brands, especially recently. And I'm curious like how you think about TikTok's impact from your perspective. And is it like similar to what Instagram's impact was a few years back? Does it feel different? How do you sort of think about TikTok as a channel for e-com?
Yeah, I think that you're spot on. Is there's only I feel like sometimes you like know, or hopefully beforehand, not retroactively, like, okay, this is like a channel that like I have to pounce on. And there's always like, and I talked about earlier about around prioritization, but sometimes there is that shiny penny that's worth going after. And so with TikTok right now, I think for these e-commerce sellers, you have to carve off time to invest there. It is such an exciting channel. What TikTok's done on, I think, kind of helping change like consumer behavior and taking a lot of like what worked in the East and having that work here in the West has just been fascinating, how they've really focused on the whole customer experience and like the post-purchase process and everything like that. But yes, it is a channel that is blowing up, and all brands should look at that. I think it's the most exciting thing for any e-commerce seller since Instagram ads and like the heyday when people were just building these million-dollar businesses essentially on top of like Shopify and Instagram. And so I think it's, people should be jumping all over this. It reminds me of very early in my career when there was this Google Apps Marketplace, which was, I don't even know what they call it now, the Google Suite, if you will, Gmail for Business. They had this marketplace for apps and we were able to leverage it like crazy. And Google was subsidizing a ton of it as well, including like a lot of the paid search. Like they would basically, you could search for project management and they were essentially paying themselves or like project management tool or project management software. And like the number one paid ad was their app store. And then we were ranked number one and we weren't paying anything to rank number one. We just had to game it so we could be number one. And so we're basically getting all the clicks for at the top for project management software and paying nothing. So anyways, like there's sometimes these arbitrage opportunities, Instagram ads and now TikTok.
Do you see any arbitrage opportunities for B2B companies today? Because I've messed around with TikTok. We'll probably put a clip of this interview up on TikTok. But honestly, we haven't had a lot of success. You know, it's like we get 50, 60 views, like two boring guys talking about B2B SaaS. You know, it's like, but yeah, is there any arbitrage opportunities you see for B2B that you want to share? You want to keep it close?
Nothing right now, unfortunately. But I'd say still so many people neglect SEO. Depending on the team and the like experience and skill set, and of course the product, if people actually search for what you have, I think it's just such a no-brainer for people to invest in.
I think even stuff like podcasts and just building brand, I think what's people trip up at B2B SaaS is like everyone starts going down these marketing paths because I think they should, or they see other people doing it, but then they like lack the consistency and the rigor over a long term. And I think the trick with any of these programs. You just have to stick with it and you have to keep doing it and you build a brand and you can't look for like that immediate ROI. Because if you look for the immediate ROI, we'd have stopped this podcast after, you know, 10 listens on the first episode. But like, I look at this as like, all right, 5 years from now, if I could be, you know, a mini Joe Rogan for B2B SaaS, great. You know, like even if I had 5,000 people listening, like that would be huge and it could drive, you know, compounding effects for the business. So I don't know. I think consistency is a funny arbitrage opportunity for a lot of companies.
Agreed. Also, it's not just always quantity. Like, what is the quality that you're getting? Because if you're viewed as this voice in the ecosystem for your industry, and then these larger companies will then take you more seriously earlier in the journey, you know, that could have massive ROI.
One fun thing I saw you guys do is I think you brand your ShipBob trucks, right? So you say you don't own them, but you brand them. Can you talk about how that came to be? Or maybe it's, I don't know if that's a fun story, but I saw it. I was like, oh, that's cool. I want trucks that have my brand on it.
So book that I'm sure other people mention a bit as well, but like, so Marshall McLuhan's with Medium is the Message, where he essentially says like how you get in front of your customers is equal, if not more important than what you get in front of your customers. That's essentially the crux of the book. And so for us, as we're fulfilling goods, I really want to think through that of like how we can get in front of our customers is very important. And so in that simultaneous with, but at the end of the day, we're this fulfillment technology solution. Like, it doesn't really get much more boring than that. But you know what's pretty cool is some of the brands that we work with. Like, we work with some really cool brands. And so can we position ourselves alongside these cool brands? And so now you'll see across New York and LA and other regions, you know, it's us with Jennifer Aniston's Lola V brand, or it's Tony's, which is like one of the hottest items out there. If you go to any Target, you know, for kids, it's, you know, one of the hottest toys out there. We've got our trucks with Tom Brady's TB12 brand. And so it's really, you know, how can we partner with our customers who we're delivering all these goods for anyways, and just really elevate their presence because they love that as well. And, you know, it's helping elevate us alongside, you know, these cool commerce brands as well.
It's a great marketing campaign. And I do see that tactic a lot of like the billboards in the Bay Area. Like, Salesforce has the giant one on the 101, and they're always swapping it in with like whoever their latest big customer is, like the F1 drivers or some healthcare system and stuff. And it's just, I don't know, it perfectly makes the brand seem cooler. But then also, you know, everyone wants to buy software from, you know, people who have helped a business like them before. And so it really helps them kind of put themselves in your shoes and be like, oh, okay, well, if people use ShipBob for this, you know, or if that brand's using ShipBob for something, I could be using it too. So yeah, I love that type of marketing campaign.
And we often more just blend in the background with our customers, which we're totally fine with, like them never having any idea that, you know, the consumer's not knowing that we're part of the equation. But, you know, this is, as we evolve our brand and evolve our business, you know, is one of the first forays into just getting more into the consumer mind.
I'd love to talk a little bit more about the marketing team you've built at ShipBob. Like, what's the team look like today? How is it structured? How do you think of like the different functions you've sort of built across the team?
So to simplify it, we have our digital team. And so they focus on a lot of paid search, paid social, marketing analytics. We've got product marketing. We have content and SEO. Fortunately, the team lead there, she's well-versed across a lot of stuff. And so she oversees marketing automation and our designer and developer as well. We have our global marketing team focused, you know, in UK and Australia. And then we have partner marketing. And under that, they run all things events as well. So digital and in person too.
Gotcha. And then what do you do all day? You're a CMO. Like, what does it mean to be a CMO?
Good question. Marketing partnerships is a huge focus. I work very closely with our sales team. And so I jump on sales calls almost every day, you know, just trying to find like the biggest impact that I can have, whether it's be trying to unlock things or enable my team to hopefully have success. And also just, you know, rolling up my sleeves again, whether it be a sales call or a different marketing campaign. I met with our team earlier and we're rewriting some of our podcast ads. And so I think it's always staying close to like the individual contributor work as well, to understand like what's happening every day. And then of course, working with our other team leaders across product, across finance, you know, our CEO as well.
Yeah. How do you think about managing up? Because I think so much about CMOs are, you got to work with the executive team and the CEO and the board and to kind of communicate what you're doing. How do you think about kind of doing that?
I think one of anybody's jobs is, or job is, to make their direct manager's life easier. You know, it starts with, of course, doing your job very well so that they don't have to think about it. I think it's, especially at the beginning, so I've been at ShipBob for 5.5 years, but I think especially at the beginning, it's like over-communicating, not just with your direct manager, but other stakeholders, so they understand, like, not just performance, but like, why are you doing things? People like to learn, and how can you share that as succinctly as possible? And again, you don't want them to have to think about it. And so anytime you start a new role, people are naturally like, you know, they're hopeful that their new hire is going to do a good job, but how can you get their confidence level as high as possible so that they can focus on other parts of the business? And again, so I think that's, you know, really the focus, especially to start.
I'm curious how you've thought about kind of building your own marketing career, because you've done a lot of different things. You've done e-commerce, you've worked in B2B SaaS, both at Mavenlink, BigCommerce, and ShipBob. You've actually, I think, ran several digital marketing agencies in your career. Like, how do you sort of think about, if looking back on your career journey, and like, you know, for younger marketers who want to be a CMO one day, what do you recommend they do? Should they go spend time at agencies? Should they go in-house? Should they develop skills in a specific functional area? Like, how do you think about kind of advising the next generation of marketers?
I think I, especially with the first agency that I ran with my business partner, and he's actually my cousin, we fortunately worked with these earlier stage companies where they're like, you know, maybe they said, I need X, meaning like maybe they need paid search or SEO or whatever it may be. What they really were saying was, I need revenue. And so we just kind of had to figure out through any channel possible for those specific clients, like what's going to actually drive not just leads, not just opportunities, but revenue. Because if they're not, it's early stage. And so if they're not able to show revenue growth, then they're not going to be able to afford an agency or even have a business to stand on. And so that was very fortunate, again, just to get a lot of visibility into like basically standing up all these channels. And then we got involved in product and engineering and a bunch of stuff because we just would have to build all these things. In like the right path, I mean, I don't think there's any right path. You know, it's kind of like the crappy but honest answer. Like, I think there's so much value. I think it's just maximizing what you can get out of wherever your starting point is. Again, if you're an agency, the beauty of an agency is often you can see many different clients and spread yourself across so much and maybe a bunch of different channels. Often the problem is you can't go that deep. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to go in-house, is I just really wanted to go, because I felt like a lot of the stuff I was doing was so surface level. I wanted to go much deeper and deeper in the sales process, deeper in just like the entire product stack. And I think if you work at a larger company, something that I didn't fully, honestly, until I was a little older, didn't really see the full value of until I joined BigCommerce, is not only the relationships and knowledge you'll get from your marketing colleagues, but also from people across so many different departments. And so again, I think it's more of like, well, where are you today? And like, how do you like maximize that? And so again, if you're like in a larger company, it's like, okay, great. I bet some of our leadership is extremely strong. Like, how do I learn from them? And maybe it's like, okay, I love what she does, I'm going to do that, but I hate what he does, I'm never going to do that. Like, you can learn from the bad as well. Who are the top performers on sales? Go sit with them. You know, who are the top product managers? Like, who keeps getting promoted? Like, go talk to them. And so I think it's just like maximizing your time there. And so something that I talk to my team about a lot is like, if you think of, you just got to view your career over like a very long time horizon, and then you're trying to add like all these like skills that will then compound over time. And so maybe you start off within, I don't know, paid search, but then you can understand, well, paid search informs SEO, so then I can learn SEO. And then you go, okay, well, there's some similarities to like affiliate. And so then now when you add affiliate, and then you go, okay, well, where are these leads going? I need to understand sales. So now you start understanding like the sales process better, maybe revenue operations better. And so you just start adding these different skills over time. And then the value of those just continues to compound, because those channels or those skills together, I think, elevate everything. But then just as you continue to spend more time there, you just continue to get, you know, more and more proficient.
It's such a good answer, because I think, I mean, it's basically what I'm hearing is like, if you want to be a well-rounded marketer, you need to like run towards your weaknesses, like not just focus on your strengths of, oh, I'm really good at paid search, but okay, if I don't know something about SEO or these tangential things, I actually need to go seek out and learn and talk to people and figure it out. And like, once you do that, that compounds, and that's how you can be like a marketing leader one day. So yeah, I really liked your answer.
Yeah. And I think it's you're not always going to make the right decisions. Like, I mean, people often say, oh, you're, you know, whether, like with startups, they'll be like, oh, you guys went up and to the right. But yeah, there's like so much craziness that happens underneath. And so it's more of like, well, what are some skills that will like complement what I do today? Maybe it's storytelling. Maybe it's understanding product-led growth better. I don't know what it is. But as long as you, I think when you look at it and just diving deep. And so again, it is seeing maybe your weaknesses or what you don't know that well. But yeah, like what can really complement what you do today?
I'd love to end today's conversation kind of just talking about like the state of e-commerce right now, because it's been a crazy couple of years. Mm. You know, you had the boom cycle in COVID, then kind of maybe a bust cycle right after that. Like, how is e-commerce feeling at the moment? And then I don't know if you have any insight into where it will go. That's always a funny question. But yeah, how are you sort of feeling about e-commerce today?
Well, naturally, I'm very bullish on where it's going to go, or else I wouldn't be in this industry. Yeah, post-COVID was maybe tougher because there wasn't quote unquote free growth, but there was still a lot of growth and a lot of growth for a ton of companies. So whether it's the brands or the vendors that support them, I think what it forced is what a lot of people were, you know, reading, whether it be mainstream media, whether it's in a bunch of different industries, is really like a focus on just running a much stronger, like real business. And so again, post ZIRP, like you just have to have a much closer eye on all costs because money is more expensive. And so I think people just really cleaned up, like, how are they running their business? Whether that be headcount, whether that be who their partners are, whether that be how they manufacture goods, maybe how they ship goods, maybe the marketing channels that they go after, maybe allowing for slightly slower growth so that they can really reaccelerate later as they clean up their house. And so I think that the brands that are doing well today are just set up for just so much long-term success. I think people have also just been looking at different channels. And so a lot of people were focused maybe just on direct to consumer, but now there's, you know, a lot of the social networks like TikTok and Instagram and YouTube shopping that are blowing up. There's just a lot of the retailers. I think Target's pulled a lot of this forward, but a lot of the different retailers are starting to work with brands in an earlier stage. And it's not just selling within their physical stores, but they also have their marketplaces. And then fortunately, not to like overly plug ShipBob, but like, you know, there's solutions out there that will allow these companies to sell across all these just different emerging channels and platforms or ERP solutions will help them manage their business. And so I'm really bullish on just where commerce in general is going, because people aren't going to stop buying stuff. And I think that a lot of these, you know, brand operators just have their businesses in such strong positions compared to maybe where they were a few years ago.
I think that's a great place to end it. Thank you so much for the conversation today, Casey.
Yeah, Alex, really appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
That's a wrap on another episode of Grow and Tell. If you enjoyed the show, subscribe to us on YouTube or your favorite podcast platform, or find every episode at growandtellshow.com. I'm your host, Alex Krakow. Thank you for listening.